content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, my name is Kenny for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Education Today. We'll get started with an article from Education News, and it's entitled, Gun Safety Advocates, Educators Call on Congress, Again, to Take Up Gun Legislation. After a school shooting at Timberview High School in Arlington, Texas this week, advocates sounded the alarm to the White House and Congress. As more than 50 million children returned to in-person learning this summer and fall, many of whom stepped into classrooms for the first time in 18 months, educators, school leaders, and parents braced for the impact of students' social and emotional learning loss and the uptick in anxiety, depression, and other mental health crises both caused and exacerbated by the coronavirus pandemic. But Joe Erardi, who took over as superintendent of schools in Newtown, Connecticut, in the wake of the massacre at Sandy Hook Elementary School that left 20 children and 6 staff members dead, knew that the back-to-school season would be difficult and dangerous like never before. If we had this conversation in July and the question was asked, what do we think is going to happen at the start of this school year, I would have been absolutely emphatic with my response to that question that this will be the most violent, most upsetting, most horrible start to public schools across the country, said Erardi, who is now a school safety consultant for AASA, the School Superintendents Association. And so sadly, I'm right. Between August 1 and September 15, there have been 30 instances of gunfire on school grounds, killing 5 and wounding 23, according to Everytown for Gun Safety, the highest count and most number of people shot during that back-to-school period since the organization began tracking gunfire on school grounds in 2013. Another school shooting was added to that list Wednesday morning, when an 18-year-old student at Timberview High School in Arlington, Texas, shot and injured 3 people after an altercation with another classmate escalated. There were 4 reported injuries. A 15-year-old boy remains in critical condition. While a teacher is in good condition, a 3rd victim was grazed by a bullet and was released from the hospital, and a 4th injury resulted from a fall, but that person was treated on the scene. When you are aware that there are over 5 million children in the U.S. who live in a home with an unsecured firearm, that's a formula for a horrible thing, he said Thursday on a press call planned prior to the school shooting in Texas that brought together gun safety advocates, educators, and researchers to call on Congress, yet again, to pass firearms legislation. You parlay that with the anxiety and stress that pre-K through 12 children have lived through for the last 18 months, Erardi said. If you allow this country's most complex minds to stay home and plan for 18 months, it is a formula for a horrible school opening, and that's exactly what's taken place. Erardi was joined by Shannon Watts, founder of Moms Demand Action, Becky Pringle, president of the National Education Association, Randy Weingartner, president of the American Federation of Teachers, and more. Their calls for background checks, secure firearm storage, age requirements for purchasing, extreme risk protection orders, and more are hardly new. They're demands that have been made for more than a decade and come at a time when Congress is legislatively overburdened with raising the debt ceiling and negotiating a path forward for the president's infrastructure and family proposals. Watts said the coalition is mounting a new effort to pressure the Biden administration to prioritize the gun safety legislation passed by the House in June, but has yet to move in the Senate, where moderates, like Senator Joe Manchin, a West Virginia Democrat, have opposed the legislation. We're coming together today after yet another school shooting tragedy, said Watts. It has been a long pandemic and it's still going on. I know families all across the country were eager to get kids back into the classrooms this fall. Sadly, back-to-school has meant back-to-school shootings for too many communities across the country. There have been school shootings in parking lots and in classrooms, during sporting events and homecoming dances, not to mention the dozens of guns that have been found on school grounds without having been fired, she said. In addition to putting the White House and Congress on alert, the groups implored schools to rethink their use of metal detectors, traumatic school shooting drills, and policies that arm educators and put police officers in schools, so-called school hardening strategies that they say have adverse effects on learning, especially for students of color. Earlier this month, the coalition released a joint statement warning about the high risk of gun violence in schools and urged the Education Department to encourage school districts to send parents information on how to safely store firearms. Long before the COVID-19 pandemic, this country was dealing with an epidemic of gun violence, Pringle said, and as schools returned to in-person learning, The shootings at our schools have continued. Way too often, students are coping with the trauma of gun violence. We are tired of thoughts and prayers. That is why we are here demanding action, she said. The House has done its job by taking action to protect our students and communities with common sense gun violence prevention. It's time that the Senate stops stalling. This next article comes from Education Week, and it's entitled, COVID cases among children are declining. Has the back-to-school surge peaked? The latest coronavirus wave may be subsiding for school-aged children, but the worry is that the good news may harden resistance to vaccination and other mitigation practices schools are using to keep outbreaks in check. The number of new child COVID cases remains exceptionally high, the American Academy of Pediatrics reported as of September 30th, with more than 173,000 cases added from state data in the past week. Yet the overall infection rates among both young and older children appear to have peaked, according to data from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. As of October 2nd, the CDC projected infection rates of nearly 145 per 100,000 children ages 5 to 11, 144 for ages 12 to 15, and 148 for those ages 16 to 17. A month ago, infection rates for adolescents were more than double that, and nearly double for elementary-age children. It's not entirely clear why pediatric infections have dropped so precipitously, though experts have cited rising vaccination rates and community saturation from Delta among possible reasons. Dr. Tina Tan, a pediatric infectious disease doctor at Lurie Children's Hospital in Chicago and a coronavirus expert with the Infectious Disease Society of America, said the decline represents a normal ebb in the circulation of the Delta variant in the community. In fact, U.S. school openings may have extended the Delta wave longer in the United States than in other countries such as India and the United Kingdom, according to Dr. David Kimberlin, a professor and co-director of pediatric infectious diseases at the University of Alabama at Birmingham and Children's of Alabama Hospital. This pandemic surge did stay with us longer than some of the prior ones did, Kimberlin said. I think that may have been related to children going back to school at the same time that we were being hit so hard with Delta. But Tan and Kimberlin said it may be too early to consider the latest wave fully passed, as some expect a resurgence this winter as more people stay indoors in closer contact. You know, if you had asked me in June if I anticipated such a horrific, truly terrible, horrifying experience in August and September that we've had, I would have said no, I don't, Kimberlin said. I think that we need to maintain our diligence and we need to be ready for a next wave, because each time we've had a very bad wave, we thought it's been the last. And every single time so far, we've been wrong. This subsection is called Vaccinations Are Rising. The CDC has found more than half of 16 to 17-year-olds have been fully vaccinated, but less than 45% of 12 to 15-year-olds have had a full course of coronavirus vaccine. About 55% of those younger teens and more than 62% of older adolescents have had at least one dose, but the burst of outbreaks among children that came with the start of school has helped spur vaccination. This week, Pfizer BioNTech, the developer of the coronavirus vaccine approved for adolescents aged 12 and up, formally asked the Food and Drug Administration for emergency approval to provide vaccine for 5 to 11-year-olds as well. The FDA's review committee was set to analyze the evidence on the vaccine's safety and effectiveness on October 26th, but some preliminary research has already found children can have a strong immune response even with a dose one-third as large as that given to older adolescents and adults. If child case rates continue to decline, school leaders may face more inertia from families on immunizing their children, said Nat Malkus, an education policy researcher with the American Enterprise Institute who has been studying public opinion on pandemic mitigation efforts. Especially for those folks who are nervous about whether vaccines are safe or have some reason to avoid them, they will be past the pressure point when they might crack on that, he said. Malkus and his AEI colleagues found, in a nationally representative survey, that parents have on average been more reluctant to approve of child vaccination than the public as a whole. While Republican parents were three times less likely than Democrat parents to say they would get their 5 to 11-year-old children immunized as soon as a coronavirus vaccine is approved, 20% versus 63%, parents across the political aisle were more hesitant than other adults. It's one thing for someone to say, I'm willing to take the risk in choosing whether or not to be vaccinated, Malkus said. It's very different to say, I'm willing to take the risk with my 11-year-old. In most states, children under 18 still make up less than 10% of new COVID-19 infections, but that proportion has climbed in recent weeks in the West and Northeast. Consistency will be key to keeping the momentum in schools that hope to have all students vaccinated, Malkus said. Pretty eminently, we're looking at the likelihood of vaccine authorization for 5 to 11-year-olds, and it's going to be even more critical that schools double and triple and quadruple down on that, Kimberlin said. I do know that things have gotten really very contentious between school leaders, school boards, and some very loud, angry components of their districts. I really, really think they are the minority, and school district superintendents and boards of education need to be leaders. They need to step forward and say, the science is clear. These vaccines are remarkably effective and remarkably safe, and we want everyone to be vaccinated. This next article comes from NBC News, and it's entitled, New York City to phase out gifted and talented public school programs that critics call racist. The era of judging four-year-olds based on a single test is over, Mayor Bill de Blasio said. New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio unveiled a plan Friday to phase out the gifted and talented programs for elementary school students that many educators say discriminate against Black and Hispanic children enrolled in the nation's largest public school system. It will be replaced by a program called Brilliant NYC that will expand the pool of students being offered accelerated learning and not limit it to just the incoming kindergartners who scored well on an optional exam that put them on a path to attend the city's elite middle schools and high schools. The era of judging four-year-olds based on a single test is over, de Blasio said in a statement. Brilliant NYC will deliver accelerated instruction for tens of thousands of children as opposed to a select few. Every New York City child deserves to reach their full potential, and this new equitable model gives them that chance. De Blasio's announcement, which came in the waning days of his final term in City Hall, sent shockwaves through New York City that are likely to be felt in public school systems across the country, grappling with similar kinds of racial disparities. The new plan comes 2 years after a diversity task force in New York recommended scrapping most selective programs that use test scores and other criteria to determine class placement, and which helped create a two-tier school system where 75% of the students in gifted and talented programs were either white or of Asian descent, while the students who didn't make that cut were relegated to inferior schools with fewer resources. Currently, the program admits only 2,500 pupils a year out of 65,000 kindergartners citywide. Critics, including some fellow Democrats, quickly pounced on de Blasio's move. Gifted and talented programs have been an integral option for generations of school kids, tweeted State Senator John Liu, a Democrat from Queens who chairs a panel on New York City schools. At Bill de Blasio promised intensive public engagement about it, but now wants total elimination. A top official at the National Association for Gifted Children, which advocates for gifted and talented programs, said equity in gifted education must be addressed, but de Blasio's plan falls short. Though we support several aspects of Brilliant NYC, such as increased teacher training and the elimination of a single gifted identification exam, we are not confident that accelerated learning by itself will meet the needs of our gifted learners equally, Laurie Kirsch, president of the NAGC Board of Directors, said. Moving forward, I'm hopeful that the mayor and New York City Department of Education will reconsider this plan and keep the best interests of our gifted children in mind. Asian American activists have been among the most vocal opponents of dismantling gifted and talented programs, which they see as a way for the community to advance. The elimination of the GNT program is just another example of this administration's continued assault on high-achieving students and accelerated learners, said Yatin Chu, co-president of Place NYC, a New York City advocacy group. Some public school parents also expressed alarm. Marsha Benjamin Charles, 44, a mother of two public school students in Brooklyn, said she fears de Blasio's move will result in an exodus of bright students to charter schools. I'm African American, and a lot of African American children are going to charter schools now, she said. Benjamin Charles said she considered moving her oldest child, who is now 20, to a charter school after the gifted and talented classes he attended until the fourth grade were discontinued at his school. But she ended up keeping him there and he graduated second in his class. I was a public school student, Benjamin Charles, who works as a transitional care manager, said. I turned out fine. I want to give my children the same education. But Sox Vey of Queens, whose 14-year-old daughter is a public school student, said de Blasio's new plan will level the playing field. She said that while her daughter is thriving despite not being in a gifted and talented program, basing children's future on how they perform on a test taken at age 4 is unfair to the parents who have neither the time nor resources to prep their kids for this examination. It's really exclusionary because when you think about a lot of immigrant parents who cannot read or do not have the time to go through this whole process, their kids will probably be missing out on better programs on account of just being shut out from understanding the process, Svay, a Cambodian refugee who was raised in the Bronx, said. Class segregation, which leads to racial segregations, needs to stop. Under de Blasio's plan, students enrolled in the gifted and talented programs will stay in them. But the programs will no longer exist for incoming kindergarten students next fall. Instead of the much-criticized entrance exam, the city will sort out which third graders should be put in accelerated classes by evaluating their schoolwork and getting input from their teachers. The city will also train all kindergarten teachers to provide accelerated learning in areas ranging from robotics and computer coding to community organizing. No longer will these students deemed gifted be separated from their other peers. Instead, they will spend several periods a day working on specific subject areas with specially trained teachers before returning to their regular classes. The move also puts de Blasio's likely successor, Eric Adams, in a bind. A Democrat in an overwhelmingly Democratic city, Adams campaigned on a promise to expand the existing gifted and talented program to lower-income neighborhoods, and it would be up to him to implement this new program should he be elected. Eric will assess the plan and reserves his right to implement policies based on the needs of students and parents should he become mayor, Evan Theas, a spokesman for Adams' campaign, told the New York Times. Clearly, the Department of Education must improve outcomes for children from lower-income areas. Adams' Republican rival, Curtis Sliwa, said he benefited from taking accelerated classes at his Brooklyn Middle School and that New Yorkers should have, quote, more gifted and talented programs, not less. My youngest sons tried to get into the gifted and talented program, but they did not qualify because there weren't enough slots, he said in an email. New York City is one of the most diverse cities in the country, but the Civil Rights Project at the University of California, Los Angeles, reported in June that the city's public schools are the most segregated in the nation. 2/3 of a century after the Supreme Court said that segregated schools are, quote, inherently unequal, New York is a national epicenter of racial segregation in unequal schools, Gary Orfield, co-director of the Civil Rights Project, wrote. This next article comes from USA Today, and it's called We Are One. New Mexico school comes together to support a classmate bullied for wearing a hijab. When a seventh grader confided in social studies teacher Janice Adams after several students bullied her for wearing her hijab at school, tears pooled in her eyes. Students had hurled Islamophobic insults. One student was dared to rip off her hijab, a traditional head covering worn by Muslim women, but he didn't go through with it. She was crying and she said she felt pretty alone, said Adams, a teacher at Camino Real Middle School in Las Cruces. I told her how amazing she is and that she's loved. Adam brought the girl to Brittany Johnson, a special education teacher who advises the school's leadership class and student council. In Johnson's classroom, the two teachers listened. It breaks my heart to know that this is even something we have to talk about, Johnson said. Bullying is not something we take lightly. I suddenly felt that we needed to show everyone, not just her, but her bullies as well, that we are one. You're not going to do that to one of our students. You're not going to make somebody feel like they're alone. The next day, Johnson's leadership class, the student council, and members of the school's football and volleyball teams came together to escort the seventh grader between classes to show their support. About 100 students gathered to walk her to class, Johnson said. Adams put together photos from the student escort and posted a video on TikTok with the caption, "We are Camino Wildcats. Way to show we are one. We don't tolerate bullying." Principal Michelle Harris said the student escort shows that bullying is not tolerated at Camino Real. From the moment that happened, our teachers took a leadership role, Harris said. Our students took a leadership role. What came out of that was a shift in the climate and the culture of our school. It was one event. It was two teachers. It was 100 kids. And now it's the entire population of our learning community, Harris added. I'm really proud of them. No students have been disciplined for the Islamophobic bullying, but Harris said there has been no further bullying. The school district, which recently accepted an anti-bullying proclamation, has a series of presentations planned to bring awareness to bullying for Bullying Prevention Month in October. What we're trying to emphasize is the root cause of bullying, said Amy Himmelwright, the school district's director of mental health and academic counseling. We acknowledge that kids who bully likely have untreated trauma, mental distress, or environmental factors themselves. So not only do we need to treat and protect, obviously, any victims of bullying, but we take the stance that we also have to treat the bully. Having an adult that students feel comfortable confiding in is vital when preventing bullying, Adams said. It's important to build that relationship with your students, so when they're in a situation, they know they have a safe place to come to you, Adams said. I think every teacher strives every day to create that environment for our students. I'm just glad she could come to me. This next article also comes from U.S. News, and it's entitled Biden Administration to Make Major Changes to Student Loan Forgiveness Program. Education Secretary Miguel Cardona will publicly announce changes to make it easier to qualify for the Public Service Loan Forgiveness Program. The Biden administration outlined major changes to the federal public service loan forgiveness program on Wednesday, a promise made by the government to provide debt relief to teachers, nurses, firefighters, and others who go into public service jobs, but one that's been mired by complicated eligibility rules and servicing errors that have made it nearly impossible to benefit from. Borrowers who devote a decade of their lives to public service should be able to rely on the promise of public service loan forgiveness, said Education Secretary Miguel Cardona. The system has not delivered on that promise to date, but that is about to change for many borrowers who have served their communities and their country. The burdensome technical rules and mismanagement have haunted the public service loan forgiveness plan since it was first established in 2008. Not only must borrowers be employed in a public sector job, but they are required to make 120 on-time student loan payments and participate in a qualified repayment plan. In addition, the loans borrowers took out must be a specific type to qualify, the federal direct loans versus federal family education loans, and they are not allowed to defer payments or go into forbearance. But thousands of borrowers who have worked in qualified public service jobs have been blocked from qualifying for the program, and thousands more who thought they were making on-time repayments through a qualified repayment plan, even told by their loan servicer that they were doing so, were later told those payments did not qualify because they had been made under the wrong repayment plan. Moreover, when borrowers consolidated their loans, their on-time payments that they had been making toward the 120 payments required under the program were wiped clean and they had to begin all over. Another major issue. Service members who are on active duty can qualify for student loan deferments and forbearances that help them through periods in which they have difficulty making payments. But those deferments and forbearances granted while they served have never been counted toward their public student loan forgiveness. In fact, the rules surrounding how a borrower can qualify and count payments toward the program have been so onerous that only 16,000 borrowers have ever received forgiveness under the plan since it was first offered in 2008, according to the Education Department. A 2019 report from the Government Accountability Office found that only 1.3% of applicants were approved for loan forgiveness. Department officials estimate the new changes would help more than 550,000 borrowers who has previously consolidated their loans, including 22,000 borrowers who will be immediately eligible to have $1.74 billion in federal student loans discharged, and another 27,000 borrowers who could potentially qualify for $2.82 billion in forgiveness if they certify periods of their employment. Teachers, nurses, first responders, service members, and so many public service workers have had our back, especially amid the challenges of the pandemic, Cardona said. Today, the Biden administration is showing that we have their backs, too. Specifically, the changes announced on Wednesday will allow borrowers to count prior payments they made as going toward payments made under the Public Service Loan Forgiveness Program, regardless of what type of loan program they have or consolidated previous loans into, so long as they worked for a qualified employer. The department will also simplify what it means for a payment to qualify for public service loan forgiveness, addressing one of the most pressing concerns voiced in the 48,000 comments received on the issue, that too many payments do not count toward the forgiveness program due to technical requirements like the timing and amount of payments made. In some instances, department officials said borrowers missed out on credit toward public service loan forgiveness because their payments were off by a penny or two or late by only a few days. In addition, the department plans to allow months that military service members spent on active duty to count toward the program, to review applications that were denied for the program, increase outreach to those who do qualify but have not signed up for the program, simplify the application process, and make additional long-term improvements. Overhauling the public service loan forgiveness program has been a stated priority for the Biden administration, which posted a public request for comments and information on how to make it better in July, a request that received more than 48,000 responses. The announcement is just the latest of several major changes to federal student loan repayment and forgiveness policies by the Biden administration, which has now approved more than $11.5 billion in loan cancellation for more than 580,000 borrowers. Currently, the department is overseeing a negotiated rulemaking process in an effort to overhaul regulations related to for-profit colleges, including borrower forgiveness, as well as other issues related to public service loan forgiveness, including potentially expanding or redefining the definition of public service. Democratic lawmakers were quick to cheer the announced changes to the public service loan forgiveness program. This is the comprehensive and sustainable solution that student borrowers deserve, and it will be a major victory for thousands of nurses, teachers, first responders, and other public service workers, Representative Bobby Scott, Virginia Democrat and Chairman of the Education and Labor Committee, said in a statement. The Public Service Loan Forgiveness Program was not designed to be a puzzle or a contest, he said. It was designed as a tool to recruit talented people into public service and recognize their contribution to our communities. Republicans, while largely agreeing that the program was mismanaged and caused widespread confusion, were much less enthused with the Education Department's proposed fix, which they say amounts to, quote, an abuse of executive authority. We agree this program is in desperate need of reform, Representative Virginia Fox, North Carolina Republican and ranking member of the Education and Labor Committee, wrote in a letter to Cardona on Monday. However, such reforms require congressional action, and we encourage you to work with us to fix the federal loan and repayment program. Cardona will publicly announce the changes to the Public Service Loan Forgiveness Program with Undersecretary of Education James Cavall on Wednesday afternoon during a roundtable event alongside a member of the Army National Guard, a math teacher, and epidemiologist, all of whom stand to benefit from the changes. We've run out of time for this episode of Education Today. Please be sure to tune in next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Kenny Yee for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Education Today is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.